Rolf's Mycenaeans positioned their fire lances, bracing the metal contraptions on the wall itself. Morath marched. There would be no more delays, no more surprises. This battle would unfold. Adian glanced toward the curve of the fluorine, the ice sheets glaringly bright in the morning sun. He shut out the dread in his heart. They were too desperate, too outnumbered for him to deny Lysandra the task she'd taken on today. A look over his shoulder. Had Adian confirming that Bane's soldiers had the catapults primed atop the battlements. The Fey Royals ready to use their depleted magic to levitate the enormous blocks of river stone into place. And on the city walls, Fey archers remained watchful as they waited for their own signal. Adian knocked an arrow into his bow, arm straining as he pulled back the string. As one, the army gathered on the city walls did the same.
"Let's make this a fight worthy of a song," Adian said.
Chapter 85. Manon and the 13 shot into the skies as the Kraken army flowed below, a red tide rushing toward the sea of black ahead. Forcing the Iron Teeth Legion to choose, their ancient enemies or their new ones. It was a test, and one Manon had wanted to make early, to see how many of the Iron Teeth would heed the command to plow forward, and how many might break from their orders, the temptation of battling the 13 too much to bear. And a test, she supposed, for the matrons and the heirs who led their legion. Would they fall for it? Split their forces to swarm the Iron Teeth? Or continue their assault on the Krakens? Higher and higher, Manon and the 13 rose, the two armies nearing each other. The Krakens didn't hesitate as their swords glinted in the sun, pointing toward the oncoming wyverns. The Iron Teeth had not trained against an enemy able to fight back. An enemy who could be airborne, smaller and faster, and strike where they were weakest. The riders. That was the Kraken's goal, to bring down the riders, not the beasts. But to do so, they'd need to brave the snapping jaws and spiked tails, the poison coating them. And if they could navigate around the wyverns, then the matter would remain of facing the flying arrows, the trained warriors atop the beasts. It would not be easy, and it would not be quick. The 13 rose so high that the air became thin, high enough that Manon could see to the very back of the host, where the horrific, unmistakable bulk of Iskra Yellowleg's wyvern flew. A challenge and a promise of a confrontation to come. Manon knew, despite the distance, that Iskra had marked her. No sign of Petra, or of the two remaining matrons. Who had replaced the Yellowleg's crone to become High Witch? Manon didn't know, or care. Perhaps her grandmother had convinced them not to appoint Iskra or a new one just yet, to clear the way for her own path to queendom. Just as Manon's head turned light at the altitude, 50 or so wyverns peeled away from the enemy's host, flying upward, racing for them, beasts freed of their tether, hungry for the glory and bragging rights that killing the 13 would win. Manon smiled. The two armies slammed into each other. Loosing a breath, Manon yanked once on Abraxos's reins. Her fierce-hearted wyvern flung out his wings as he arched and plummeted. The world tilted while they twisted and plunged down, 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 the 13 falling with them. They tore through wisps of cloud, the clashing army blurring, the castle and city looming below. And when the Iron Teeth were close enough that Manon could see they were yellow legs and blue bloods, Abraxos banked sharply to one side, and a current launched him right into the heart of them. The 13 snapped into formation behind her, a battering ram that smashed through the Iron Teeth. Manon's bow sang as she fired arrow after arrow. At the first spray of blue blood, some part of her slipped away, but she kept firing, and Abraxos kept flying, ripping apart wing and throat with his tail and teeth. And so, it began. Even in the river, The thunder of marching feet rumbled past Lysandra. They didn't see the large white snout that periodically broke through the ice floes to huff down a breath. The sky was dark now, thick with the clashing of wyverns and crokins. Bodies occasionally plunged into the river, Iron Teeth and Crokin alike. The crokins who thrashed, who were still alive, Lysandra covertly carried to the far shore. What they made of her, they didn't say. She didn't linger long enough to let them. The Iron Teeth who fell into the river were dragged to the bottom and pinned to the rocks. She'd had to look away each time she did it. Lysandra's snout broke the surface as a sharp horn shattered over the din, right from the city walls. Not a warning call, but an unleashing. Lysandra dove to the bottom, dove and then pushed up, mighty tail thrashing to launch her toward the surface. She broke from the ice on the water, arcing through the air, and slammed right into Morath's eastern flank. Soldier screamed as she unleashed herself in a whirlwind of teeth and claws and a massive snapping tail. Where the white sea dragon moved, black blood sprayed. And just when the soldiers mastered their terror enough to launch arrows and spears at the opalescent scales enforced with spider silk, she twisted and flipped back into the deep river, vanishing beneath the ice. Spears plunged into the turquoise waters, missing their mark, but Lysandra was already racing past. The sea dragon's body, river dragon, she supposed, didn't slow. She pushed it to its limit, the great lungs working like a bellows. The river curved, and she used it to her advantage as she leaped from the water again. The soldiers, so focused on the damage she'd done up ahead, didn't look her way until she was upon them. She had all of a glance to the city walls, where a wave of black now crashed against them, siege ladders rising and arrows flying, bursts of flame amid it all, before she returned to the river's icy depths. Black blood streamed from her maw, from her tails and claws, as she doubled back, the shadow of the witches warring overhead upon the ice above her. So she fought, the ice floes her shield, attacking, then moving, destabilizing the eastern flank with every assault, forcing them to flee from the river's edge to crowd the center ranks. Slowly, the turquoise waters of the Florine clouded blue and black. Still, Lysandra kept ripping bites from the side of the behemoth that launched itself upon Orinth. The heat off the fire lances scorched Adian's cheek, warming his helmet to near discomfort. A small price, as the bursts of flame sent the Volg foot soldiers at the walls scrambling back. Where their archers felled the enemy, more came. And where the fire lances melted them away, only scorched earth and melted armor remained. But there was not enough, not even close. Above, beyond the walls, the Iron Teeth and Crokins clashed. So violently, so quickly, that a blue mist hung in the skies from the bloodshed. He couldn't determine who had the upper hand. The 13 fought amongst them, and where they plunged into the fray, Iron Teeth and their mounts tumbled, crushing Volg foot soldiers beneath them. Iron siege ladders rose again, aiming for the city walls. Answering blasts from the fire lances sent those already on them to the ground as charred corpses. But more Volg scrambled up, the fear of flame not enough to deter them. Sprinting to the nearest ladder, Adian knocked arrow after arrow, firing at the soldiers creeping up its rungs. Clean shots through the gaps in the dark armor. The archers around him did the same, and the Bane soldiers behind him settled into fighting stances, waiting for the first to breach the walls. At the city gates, flame blasted and raged. He'd concentrated many of the Mycenaeans at either of the two gates into Orinth, their most vulnerable weakness along the walls. That the fire kept flaring as it did told him enough. Morath was making its push there. Rolf's order to conserve fire set a pit of dread forming in his gut, but Adian focused on the siege ladder. His bow twanged, and another soldier tumbled away, then another. Down the wall, Ren had taken on the other nearby siege ladder, the Lord's bow singing. Adian dared a glance to the army ahead. They had amassed close enough now. Falling back, letting an archer take his place, he lifted his sword, signaling the bane at the catapults, the Fey royals and archers near them. Now! Wood snapped and groaned. Boulders as large as wagons soared over the walls. Each had been oiled and gleamed in the sun while they rose. And when the boulders reached their peak, just as they began to plummet toward the enemy, the Fey archers unleashed their flaming arrows. They struck the oil-slick boulders right before the stones slammed into the earth. Flame erupted, flowing right into the holes that Adian had ordered drilled into the rock, right into the nest of the explosive powders they'd again taken from the precious reserves of Rolf's fire lances. The boulders blasted apart in balls of flame and stone. Along the city walls, soldiers cheered at the carnage that the smoking ruins revealed. Nothing but melted, squashed, or shattered Volg grunts. Every place the six catapults had fired upon now had a ring of charred ground around it. Reposition! Adian roared. The Bane were already heaving against the wheels that would rotate the catapults on their wooden stands. Within seconds, they had aimed at another spot. Within seconds, the Fey royals were lifting more oiled boulders from the stockpile Darrow had acquired over weeks and weeks. He didn't give Morath a chance to recover. Fire! Boulders soared, flaming arrows following. The explosions on the battlefield shook the city walls this time. Another cheer went up, and Adian motioned the Bane and Fey royals to halt. Let Morath think that their stock was depleted, that they only had a few lucky shots in their arsenal. Adian turned back to the siege ladder as the first of the Volg grunts cleared the walls. The man was killed before his feet finished touching the ground, courtesy of a waiting Bane soldier. Adian unstrapped the shield from across his back and angled his sword as the wave of soldiers crested the walls. But it was not a Volg foot soldier who appeared next, climbing over the ladder with ease. The young man's face was cold as death, his black eyes lit with unholy hunger. A black collar was clasped around his throat. A Volg prince had come. Chapter 86.
Focus on the ladder, Adian snarled to the soldier, shrinking from the handsome demon prince, who stepped onto the city walls as if he were merely entering a room. He wore no armor, nothing but a black tunic cut to his lithe body. The Volg prince smiled.
Prince Adian,
purred the thing inside it, drawing a sword from a dark sheath at his side.
We've been waiting for you.
Adian struck. He did not have magic, did not have anything to combat the dark power in the prince's veins, but he had speed. He had strength. Adian fainted with his sword, that ordinary nameless sword, and the prince swung with his own blade, just as Adian slammed his shield into the man's side, driving him back, not toward the ladder, but to the Mycenaean who wielded the fire lance. The Mycenaean was dead. The prince chuckled, and a whip of dark power lashed for Adian. Adian ducked, shield rising, as if it would do anything against that power. Darkness struck metal, and Adian's arms sang with the reverberations. But the pain, the life-draining agony, did not occur. Adian instantly parried, a slash upward that the Volg prince dodged with a hop to the side. The demon's eyes were wide as he took in the shield. Then Adian. Then the Volg prince hissed,
"Fey bastard."
Adian didn't know what it meant, didn't care as he took another blast upon his shield, the battlements already slick with blood, both black and red. If the Mycenaean nearby was dead, then there was another down by Ren's ladder. The Volg prince unleashed blast after blast of power. Adian took each one upon his shield, the prince's power bouncing off as if it were a spray of water upon stone. and for every burst of power sent his way, Adian swung his sword. Steel met steel. Darkness clashed with ancient metal. Adian had the vague sense of soldiers Volg and human alike halting as he and the demon prince battled their way across the city wall. He kept his feet beneath him, as Ro had taught him, as Quinn had taught him, and Cal Locken, as all his mentors and the warriors he'd admired above all others had taught him. For this moment, when he would be called to defend Orinth's very walls, it was for them he swung his sword. For them he took blow after blow. The Volg prince hissed with every blast, as if enraged that his power could not break that shield. Rose shield. There was no magic in it. Brannon had never borne it. But one of them had forged it. One of the unbroken line of kings and queens who had come after him, who had loved their kingdom more than their own lives, who had carried this shield into battle, into war, to defend Terrasen. And as Adian and the Volg prince fought along the walls, as that ancient shield refused to yield, he wondered if there was a different sort of power in the metal, one that the Volg could never and would never understand. Not true magic, not as Brannon and Aelin had, but something just as strong, stronger, that the Volg might never break, no matter how they tried. Adian's sword sang, and the Volg prince roared as Adian connected with his arm, slashing deep. Black blood sprayed. Adian leaped upon the advantage, shoving with the shield and stabbing with his blade. But the prince had been waiting, had set a trap, his own body as the bait. And as Adian slammed into the Volg prince, the demon drew a dagger from his sword belt and struck. Right where Adian's armor exposed just a sliver near his armpit, vulnerable with the outstretched position of his arm. The knife plunged in, rending flesh and muscle and bone. Pain, white hot and blinding, threatened to make him splay his hand to drop his sword. Only Adian's training, only those years of work, kept his feet under him as he leaped back, wrenching free of the knife. The Volg prince chuckled, and Adian was dimly aware of the fighting along the walls, the shouting and dying and flares of fire, as the prince smiled down at the bloodied dagger. Bringing it to his sensual mouth, the prince dragged his tongue along the blade, licked Adian's blood clean off.
Exquisite,
the demon breathed, shuddering with pleasure. Adian backed away another step, his arm burning and burning and burning, blood pooling inside his armor. The prince stalked after him. A whip of dark power launched for Adian, and he again took it on his shield, let it send him tumbling to the ground, landing atop the ironclad body of one of the Bane. His breath turned sharp as the knife that had stabbed him. The prince paused before Adian.
Feasting on you will be a delight.
Adian hefted his shield over himself, bracing for the blow. The prince made to lift the bloody dagger to his mouth again, eyes rolling back in his head. Those eyes went wide, as an arrow broke the skin of his throat, right above the collar. The prince gagged, whirling toward the arrow that had come not from Adian, but from behind, right into the path of Ren Alsbrook and the fire lance he bore in his arms. Ren slammed his hand into the release hatch, and flame erupted. Adian ducked, coiling his body beneath his shield, as the flame threatened to melt his own bones. The world was heat and light, then nothing. Only the shouts of battle and dying men. Adian managed to lower his shield. Where the Volg prince had been, a pile of ashes and a black wordstone collar remained. Adian panted, a hand going to his bleeding side.
I had him.
Ren only shook his head and pivoted on a boot, unleashing the fire lance upon the nearest Volg soldiers. The Lord of Alsbrook turned back to him, mouth open to say something. But Adian's head swam, his body plunging into a coldness he'd never known. Then there was nothing. The battle was so much worse than Evangeline had imagined. The sound alone made her quake in her bones, and only delivering messages to Lord Darrow, where he stood on one of the higher castle balconies, saved her from curling into a ball. Her breath was a ragged, dry thing as she raced back onto the balcony, to where Darrow stood by the stone railing, two other Terrasen lords beside him.
"From Killian,"
Evangeline managed to say, bobbing a curtsy, as she had each time she delivered a message. Battles were no place for manners, she knew. Aelin certainly would have said that. But she kept doing it, the curtsying, even when her legs trembled. Couldn't stop herself. Killian's messenger had met her at the castle stairs and now waited for Darrow's reply. It was as close to the fighting as she'd gotten. Not that being up here was any better. Pressing herself against the stones of the tower wall, Evangeline let Darrow read the letter. The Crokins and Wyverns were so much closer up here. This high, she stood on their level, the world a blur below. Evangeline laid her palms flat against the icy stones, as if she could draw some strength from them. Even with the roar of battle, she heard Darrow declare to the other lords,
"Adian has been wounded."
Evangeline's stomach dropped. Nausea, oily and thick, surging.
"Is he all right?"
The two other lords ignored her, but Darrow looked her way.
"He has lost consciousness, and they have moved him into a building near the wall. Healers are working on him as we speak. They will move him here as soon as he is capable of withstanding it."
Evangeline staggered to the balcony rail, as if she might see that building amid the sea of chaos by the city walls. She never had a brother, or a father. She hadn't yet decided which one she would like Adian to be. And if he was so injured that it warranted a message to Darrow? She pressed a hand to her stomach, trying to contain the bile that burned her throat. Murmuring sounded, and then there was a hand on her shoulder.
"Lord Gunnar will see to delivering my reply," Darrow said. "You will remain here with me. I might have need of you."
The words were stern, but the hand on her shoulder was kind. Evangeline only nodded, sick and miserable, and clung to the balcony rail as if her grip might somehow keep Adian on this side of life.
"Hot refreshments, Sloane," Darrow ordered, his voice brooking no room for argument.
The other lord peeled away. Evangeline didn't know how long passed after that, how long it took until the lord arrived, and Darrow pressed a scalding mug into her fingers.
"Drink."
Evangeline obeyed, finding it to be broth of some sort. Beef, maybe. She didn't care. Her friends were down there. Her family. The one she'd made. Far out, near the river, a blur of motion was her only indication that Lysandra still lived. No word arrived about Adian's fate. So Evangeline lingered on the tower, Darrow silent beside her, and prayed. Chapter 87. Even moving as fast as they could, the Coggins army was too slow. Too slow and too large to reach Terrasen in time. In the week that they'd been pushing northward, Aelin begging Oakwald, the little folk and Brannan for forgiveness, as she raised a path through the forest, they were only just now nearing Endovir, and the border mere miles beyond it. From there, if they were lucky, it'd be another 10 days to Orinth, and would likely become a disaster if Morath had kept forces stationed at Peranth after the city's capture. So they'd chosen to skirt the city on its western flank, going around the Peranth Mountains, rather than cutting to the lowlands for the easier trek across the land. With Oakwald as their cover, they might be able to sneak up on Morath at Orinth. If there was anything left of Orinth by the time they arrived. They were still too far for the Rook Riders to do any sort of scouting, and no messengers had crossed their paths. Even the wild men of the Fangs, who had remained with them and now swore to march to Orinth to avenge their kin, did not know of a faster path. Aelin tried not to think of it, or about Maeve and Erewhon, wherever they might be, whatever they might have planned. And Ovir, the only outpost of civilization they'd seen in a week, would be their first news since leaving the Farian Gap. She tried not to think of that, either. Of the fact that they would be passing through Endovir tomorrow, or the day after. That she'd see those gray mountains that had housed the salt mines. Lying on her stomach atop her cot, no point in making anyone set up a royal bed for her and Rowan when they would be marching within a few hours. Aelin winced against the stinging burn along her back. The clink of Rowan's tools and the crackle of the braziers were the only sounds in their tent. "Will it be done tonight?" she asked, as he paused to dip his needle in the pot of salt-laced ink.
"If you stop talking," was his dry reply.
Aelin huffed, rising onto her elbows to peer over a shoulder at him. She couldn't see what he inked, but knew the design. A replica of what he'd written on her back this spring. The stories of her loved ones and their deaths, written right where her scars had been. Exactly where they'd been, as if he had their memory etched in his mind. But another tattoo lay there now. A tattoo that sprawled across her shoulder bones as if it were a pair of spread wings. Or so he'd sketched for her. The story of them, Rowan and Aelin. A story that had begun in rage and sorrow and become something entirely different. She was glad to have him leave it at that, at the happiness. Aelin rested her chin atop her hands. "We'll be near Endovir soon." Rowan resumed working, but she knew he'd listened to every word, thought through his response.
"What do you want to do about it?"
She winced at the sting of a particularly sensitive spot near her spine. "Burn it to the ground? Blast the mountains into rubble?"
"Good. I'll help you."
A small smile curved her lips. "The fabled warrior prince wouldn't tell me to avoid carelessly expending my strength."
"The fabled warrior prince would tell you to stay the course. But if destroying Endovir will help, then he'll be right there with you."
Aelin fell silent, while Rowan continued working for another few minutes. "I don't remember the tattoo taking this long the last time."
"I've made improvements. And you're getting a whole new marking."
She hummed, but said nothing more for a time. Rowan kept at it, wiping away blood when necessary. "I don't think I can," Aelin breathed. "I don't think I can stand to even look at Endovir, let alone destroy it."
"Do you want me to?"
A calm warrior's question. He would, she knew. If she asked him, he'd fly to Endovir and turn it to dust.
"No,"
she admitted. "The overseers and slaves are all gone anyway. There's no one to destroy, and no one to save. I just want to pass it and never think of it again. Does that make me a coward?"
"I'd say it makes you human."
A pause,
or whatever a similar saying might be for the Fae.
She frowned at her interlaced fingers beneath her chin.
"It seems I'm more Fae these days than anything. I even forget sometimes when the last time was that I was in my human body."
"Is that a good or bad thing?"
His hands didn't falter.
"I don't know. I am human, deep down, fairy queen nonsense aside. I had human parents, and their parents were human, mostly, and even with Mab's line running true, I'm a human who can turn into fae. A human who wears a fae body." She didn't mention the immortal lifespan, not with all they had ahead of them.
"On the other hand,"
Rowan countered,
"I'd say you were a human with fae instincts. Perhaps more of them than human ones."
She felt him smirk.
"Territorial, dominant, aggressive."
"Your skills when it comes to complimenting women are unparalleled."
His laugh was a brush of hot air along her spine.
Why can't you be both human and fey? Why choose at all?
Because people always seem to demand that you be one thing or another.
You've never bothered to give a damn what other people demand.
She smiled slightly. True.
She gritted her teeth as his needle pierced along her spine.
I'm glad you're here. That I'll see Endovir again for the first time with you here.
To face that part of her past, that suffering and torment, if she couldn't yet look too closely at the last several months.
His tools, the numbing pain, halted.
Then his lips brushed the top of her spine, right above the start of the new tattoo. The same tattoo he'd had Gavriel and Fenris inking on his own back these past few days, whenever they stopped for the night.
I'm glad to be here too, Fireheart.
For however much longer the gods would allow it. Elide slumped onto her cot, groaning softly as she bent to untie the laces of her boots. A day of helping Irene in the wagon was no easy task, and the prospect of rubbing salve into her ankle and foot seemed nothing short of divine. The work, at least, kept the swarming thoughts at bay. What she'd done to Vernon, what had befallen Peranth, what awaited them at Orinth, and what they could ever do to defeat it. From the cot opposite hers, Lorcan only watched, an apple half-peeled in his hands.
You should rest more often.
Elide waved him off, yanking away her boot, then her sock.
Irene is pregnant, and throwing up every hour or so. If she doesn't rest, I'm not going to.
I'm not entirely certain Irene is fully human.
Though the voice was gruff, humor sparked in Lorcan's eyes. Elide fished the tin of salve from her pocket. Eucalyptus, Irene had said, naming a plant Elide had never heard of, but whose smell, sharp and yet soothing, she very much enjoyed. Beneath the pungent herb lay lavender, rosemary, and something else, mixed in with the opaque, pale liniment. A rustle of clothing, and then Lorcan was kneeling before her, Elide's foot in his hands. Nearly swallowed by his hands, actually.
Let me, he offered.
Elide was stunned enough that she indeed let him take the tin from her grip, and watched in silence as Lorcan dipped his fingers into the ointment, then began rubbing it into her ankle. His thumb met the spot on her ankle where bone ground against bone. Elide let out a groan. He carefully, with near reverence it seemed, began easing the ache away. These hands had slaughtered their way across kingdoms, bore the faint scars to prove it. And yet he held her foot as if it were a small bird, as if it were something holy.
They had not shared a bed, not when these cots were too small, and Elide often passed out after dinner.
But they shared this tent. He'd been careful,
perhaps too careful, she sometimes thought, to give her privacy when changing and bathing. Indeed, a tub steamed away in the corner of the tent, kept warm courtesy of Aelin. Many of the camp baths were warm thanks to her, to the eternal gratitude of royal and foot soldier alike. Alternating long strokes with small circles, Lorcan slowly coaxed the pain from her foot. Seemed content to do just that all night, should she wish it. But she was not half asleep, for once. And each brush of his fingers on her foot had her sitting up, something warming in her core. His thumb pushed along the arch of her foot, and Elide indeed let out a small noise, not at the pain, but...
Heat flared in her cheeks, grew warmer as Lorcan looked up at her beneath his lashes, a spark of mischief lighting his dark eyes.
Elide gaped a bit, then smacked his shoulder. Rock-hard muscle greeted her.
You did that on purpose.
Still holding her gaze, Lorcan's only answer was to repeat the motion.
Good. It felt so damned good.
Elide snatched her foot from his grip, closed her legs, tightly. Lorcan gave her a half-smile that made her toes curl. But then he said,
You are well and truly Lady of Peranth now.
She knew. She thought about it endlessly during these hard days of travel.
This is what you really wish to talk about?
His fingers didn't halt their miraculous, sinful work.
We haven't spoken of it. About Vernon.
What of it? She said,
trying and failing for nonchalance. But he looked up at her from beneath his thick lashes, well aware of her evasion.
Elide loosed a breath, peering up at the tense, peaked ceiling.
Does it make me any better than Vernon? How I chose to punish him in the end.
She hadn't regretted it the first day, or the second. But these long miles, as it had become clear that Vernon was likely dead, she'd wondered.
Only you can decide that, I think,
Lorcan said, yet his fingers paused on her foot.
For what it's worth, he deserved it.
His dark power rumbled through the room.
Of course you'd say that.
He shrugged, not bothering to deny it.
Peranth will recover, you know,
he offered,
from Morath's sacking. And all Vernon did to it before now.
That had been the other thought that weighed heavily with each mile northward. That her city, her father and mother's city, had been decimated. That Finula, her nursemaid, might be among the dead. That any of its people might be suffering.
That's if we win this war,
Elide said.
Lorcan resumed his soothing strokes.
Peranth will be rebuilt,
was all he said.
We'll see that it is.
Have you ever done it? Rebuilt a city?
No,
he admitted, his thumbs coaxing the pain from her aching bones.
I have only destroyed them.
His eyes lifted to hers, searching and open.
But I should like to try. With you.
She saw the other offer there. To not only build a city, but a life. Together. Heat rose to her cheeks as she nodded.
Yes,
she whispered.
For however long we have.
For if they survived this war, there was still that between them. His immortality. Something shuddered in Lorcan's eyes at that, and she thought he'd say more, but his head dipped. Then he began to unlace her other boot.
What are you doing?
Her words were a breathless rush. His deft fingers, gods above those fingers, made quick work of her laces.
You should soak that foot, and soak in general. As I said, you work too hard.
You said I should rest more.
Because you work too hard.
He jerked his chin toward the bath as he pulled off the boot and helped her rise.
I'll go find some food.
I already ate.
You should eat more.
Giving her privacy without the awkwardness of her needing to ask for it. That's what he was trying to do. Barefoot before him, Elide peered into his granite-hewn face. Shrugged out of her cloak, then jacket.
Lorcan's throat bobbed.
She knew he could hear her heart as it began racing, could likely scent every emotion on her. But she said,
I need help getting into the bath.
Do you now?
His voice was near guttural. Elide bit her lip, her breasts becoming heavy, tingling.
I might slip.
His eyes drifted down her body, but he made no move.
A dangerous time, bath time.
Elide found it in herself to walk toward the copper tub. He trailed a few feet behind, giving her space, letting her steer this. Elide halted beside the tub, steam wafting past. She tugged the hem of her shirt from her pants.
Lorcan watched every move. She wasn't entirely certain he was breathing.
But her hand stalled. Uncertain. Not of him, but this rite, this path.
Show me what to do,
she breathed.
You're doing just fine,
Lorcan ground out. but she gave him a helpless look, and he prowled closer. His fingers found the loose hem of her shirt.
May I?
He asked quietly. Elide whispered.
Yes.
Lorcan still studied her eyes, as if reading the sincerity of that word, deeming it true. Gently, he pulled the fabric from her. Cool air kissed her skin, pebbling it. The flexible band around her breasts remained, but Lorcan's gaze remained on her own.
Tell me what you want next,
he said roughly. Hand shaking, Elide grazed a finger over the band. Lorcan's own hands shook as he unbound it, as he revealed her to the air, to him. His eyes seemed to go wholly black as he took in her breasts, her uneven breathing.
Beautiful,
he murmured. Elide's mouth curled as the words settled within her. Gave her enough courage that she lifted her hands to his jacket and began unbuckling, unbuttoning, until Lorcan's own chest was bare, and she ran her fingers over the smattering of dark hair across the sculpted plains.
Beautiful,
she said. Lorcan trembled. With restraint, with emotion, she didn't know. That darling purr of his rumbled into her as she pressed her mouth against his pectoral. His hand drifted to her hair, each stroke unbinding her braid.
We only go as far and long as you want,
he said. Yet she dared to glance down his body, to what strained under his pants. Her mouth went dry.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Anything you do will be enough,
he said. She lifted her head, scanning his face.
Enough for what?
Another half smile.
Enough to please me.
She scoffed at the arrogance, but Lorcan brushed his mouth against her neck. His hands bracketed her waist, his thumbs grazing her ribs, but no higher. Elide arched into the touch, a small sound escaping her as his lips brushed just beneath her ear. And then his mouth found hers, gentle and thorough. Her hands twined around his neck, and Lorcan lifted her, carrying her not to the bath, but to the cot behind them, his lips never leaving hers.
Home. This with him?
This was home, as she had never had, for however long they might share it. And when Lorcan laid her out on the cot, his breathing as uneven as her own, when he paused, letting her decide what to do, where to take this? Elide kissed him again and whispered,
Show me everything.
So Lorcan did. There was a gate and a coffin. She had chosen neither. She stood in a place that was not a place, mist wreathing her, and stared at them. Her choices. A thumping pounded from within the coffin. Muffled female screams and pleading rising. And the gate, the black arch into eternity. Blood ran down its sides, seeping into the dark stone. When the gate had finished with the young king, this blood was all that remained.
You're no better than me,
Cairn said. She turned to him. But it was not the warrior who had tormented her standing in the mists. 12 of them lurked there. Formless and yet present, ancient and cold. As one they spoke.
Liar. Traitor. Coward.
The blood on the gate soaked into the stone, as if the gate itself devoured even this last piece of him. The one who had gone in her place. The one she'd let go in her place. The thumping from within the coffin didn't cease.
That box will never open.
They said. She blinked, and she was inside that box, the stone so cold, the air stifling. Blinked, and she was pounding on the lid, screaming and screaming. Blinked, and there were chains on her, a mask clamped over her face. Aelin awoke to dim braziers, and the pine and snow scent of her mate wrapped around her. Outside their tent, the wind howled. setting the canvas walls swaying and swelling. Tired. She was so, so tired. Aelin stared into the dark for long hours and did not sleep again. Even with the cover of Oakwald, despite the wider path that Aelin incinerated on either side of the ancient road running up through the continent like a withered vein, she could feel Endovir looming, could feel the rune mountains jutting toward them, a wall against the horizon. She rode near the front of the company, not saying much as the morning, then the afternoon, passed. Rowan stayed by her side, always remaining on her left, as if he might be a shield between her and Endovir, while she sent out plumes of flame that melted ancient trees ahead. Rowan's wind stifled any smoke from alerting the enemy of their approach. He'd finished the tattoos the night before, had taken a small hand mirror to show her what he'd done, the tattoo he'd made for them. She'd taken one look at the spread wings, a hawk's wings, across her back, and kissed him. Kissed him until his own clothes were gone, and she was astride him, neither bothering with words or capable of finding them. Her back had healed by morning, though it remained tender in a few spots along her spine. And in the hours that they'd ridden closer to Endovir, she'd found the invisible weight of the ink to be steadying. She'd gotten out. She'd survived. From Endovir and Maeve. And now it was upon her to ride like hell for the north, to try to save her people before Morath wiped them away forever. Before Erewhon and Maeve arrived to do just that. But it did not stop the heaviness, that tug toward the west. To look to the place that she had taken so long to escape, even after she'd been physically freed. After lunch, she found a lead on her right, riding in silence under the trees. Riding taller than she'd seen the girl before, a blush on her cheeks. Aelin had a feeling she knew precisely why that blush bloomed there, that if she looked behind to where Lorkin rode, she'd find him with a satisfied, purely male smile. But Elide's words were anything but those of a lovesick maiden.
I didn't think I'd really get to see Terrasen again, once Vernon took me out of Peranth.
Aelin blinked. And even the blush on Elide's face faded, her mouth tightening. Of all of them, only Elide had seen Morath, lived there, survived it. Aelin said, there was a time when I thought I'd never see it again, too. Elide's face grew contemplative.
When you were an assassin? Or when you were a slave?
Both. And maybe Elide had come to her side just to get her to talk. But Aelin explained, it was a torture of another kind when I was at Endovir. To know that home was only miles away, and that I would not be able to see it one last time before I died. Elide's dark eyes shone with understanding.
I thought I'd die in that tower, and no one would remember that I had existed.
They had both been captives. Slaves of a sort. They had both worn shackles and bore the scars of them. Or, Elide did. The lack of them on Aelin still ripped at her, an absence that she'd never thought she'd regret.
We made it out in the end, though, Aelin said.
Elide reached over to squeeze Aelin's hand.
Yes, we did.
Even if she now wished for it to be over. All of it. Her every breath felt weighed down by it, that wish. They continued on after that, and just as Aelin spied the fork in the road, the crossroads that would take them to the salt mines themselves, a warning cry went up from the Rukin, soaring along the edge between the forest and mountains. Aelin instantly had Goldrin drawn. Rowan armed himself beside her, and the entire army pausing as they scanned the woods, the skies. She heard the warning just as a dark shape shot past, so large it blotted out the sun above the forest canopy. Wyvern. Bows groaned, and the rooks were racing by, chasing after that wyvern. If an Iron Teeth scout spotted them. Aelin readied her magic. The wyvern banked toward them, barely visible through the latticework of branches. But light flared then, blasted back the Rukin, harmlessly. Not light, but ice, flickering and flashing before it turned to flame. Rowan recognized it too, roared the order to hold their fire. It was not Abraxos who landed at the crossroads, and there was no sign of Manon Blackbeak. Light flashed again. And then Dorian Haveliard stood there, his jacket and cape stained and worn. Aelin galloped down the road toward him, Rowan and Elide beside her, the others at their backs. Dorian lifted a hand, his face grave as death, even as his eyes widened at the sight of her. But Aelin sensed it then, what Dorian carried. The word keys. All three of them. Chapter 88. Adian's arm and ribs were on fire. Worse than the searing heat of the fire lances, worse than any level of Hellas's burning realm. He'd regained consciousness as the healer began her first stitches, had clamped down on the leather bit she'd offered, and roared around the pain while she sewed him up. By the time she'd finished, he'd fainted again. He woke minutes later, according to the soldiers assigned to make sure he didn't die, and found the pain somewhat eased, but still sharp enough that using his sword arm would be nearly impossible. At least until his fey heritage healed him, faster than mortal men. That he hadn't died of blood loss and could attempt to move his arm as he ordered his armor strapped back on him and stumbled into the city streets, aiming for the wall, was thanks to that fey heritage. His mother's, yes, but mostly from his father. Had Gavriel heard, across the sea or wherever their hunt for Aelin had taken him, that Terrasen was about to fall? Would he care? It didn't matter, even if part of him wished the lion were there. Rowan and the others certainly, but the steady presence of Gavriel would have been a balm to these men. Perhaps to him. Adian gritted his teeth, swaying as he scaled the blood-slick stairs to the city walls, dodging bodies both human and Volg. An hour. He'd been down for an hour. Nothing had changed. Volg still swarmed the walls and both the southern and western gates, but Terrasen's forces held them off. In the skies, the number of Krakens and Iron Teeth had thinned, but barely. The 13 were a distant, vicious cluster, ripping apart whoever flew in their path. And down at the river, red blood stained the snowy banks. Too much red blood. He stumbled a step, losing sight of the river for a moment while soldiers dispatched the Volg grunts before him. When they passed, Adian could scarcely breathe while he scanned the bloodied banks. Soldiers lay dead all around, but there, closer to the city walls than he'd realized. White against the snow and ice, she still fought, blood leaking down her sides, red blood. But she didn't retreat into the water, held her ground. It was foolish, unnecessary. Ambushing them had been far more effective. Yet Lysandra fought, tail snapping spines and giant maw ripping off heads, right where the river curved past the city. He knew something was wrong then, beyond the blood on her. Knew Lysandra had learned something that they had not, and in holding her ground tried to signal them on the walls. His head spinning, arm and ribs throbbing, Adian scanned the battlefield. A group of soldiers charged at her. A whack of her tail had the spears snapped, their bearers along with them. But another group of soldiers tried to charge past her, on the riverside. Adian saw what they bore, what they tried to carry, and swore. Lysandra smashed apart one longboat with her tail, but couldn't reach the second cluster of soldiers, bearing another. They reached the icy waters, boats splashing, and Lysandra lunged, right as she was swarmed by another group of soldiers, so many spears and lances that she had no choice but to face them, allowing the boat, and the soldiers carrying it, to slip past. Adian noted where those soldiers were headed and began shouting his orders. His head swam with each command. In Lysandra sneaking to the river through the tunnels, she'd had the element of surprise. But it had also revealed to Morath that another path existed into the city. One right below their feet. And if they got through the grate, if they could get inside the walls. Fighting against the fuzziness growing in his head, Adian began signaling. First to the shifter holding the line, trying so valiantly to keep those forces at bay. Then to the 13, perilously high in the skies, to get back to the walls. To stop Morath's creeping before it was too late. High up, the cries of the wind bleeding into those of the dying and injured. Manon saw the general signal, the careful pattern of light that he'd shown her the night before. A command to hurry to the walls, immediately, just her and the 13. The Krokens held the tide of the Iron Teeth at bay, but to fall back, to leave? Prince Adian signaled again, now, now, now. Something was wrong. Very wrong. River, he signaled, enemy. Manon cast her gaze to the earth far below and saw what Morath was covertly trying to do. To the walls, she called to the 13, still a hammer behind her, and made to steer Abraxos toward the city, tugging on the reins to have him fly high above the fray. Astarin's warning cry reached her a heartbeat too late. Shooting from below, a predator ambushing prey. The massive bull aimed right for Abraxos. Manon knew the rider as the bull slammed into Abraxos, claws and teeth digging deep. Iskra Yellowlegs was already smiling. The world tilted and spun. But Abraxos, roaring in pain, kept in the air, kept flapping. Even as Iskra's bull pulled back his head, only to close his jaws around Abraxos's throat. Chapter 89. Iskra's bull gripped him by the neck, but Abraxos kept them in the air. At the sight of those powerful jaws around Abraxos's throat, the fear and pain in his eyes. Manon couldn't breathe, couldn't think around the terror rushing through her, so blinding and sickening that for a few heartbeats, she was frozen, wholly frozen. Abraxos, Abraxos. Hers. He was hers and she was his, and the darkness had chosen them to be together. She had no sense of time, no sense of how long had passed between that bite and when she again moved. It could have been a second. It could have been a minute. But then she was drawing an arrow from her nearly depleted quiver. The wind threatened to rip it from her fingers. But she knocked it to her bow, the world spinning, 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 the wind roaring, and aimed. Iskra's bull bucked as her arrow landed, just a hair's breadth from his eye. But he did not let go. He didn't have the deep grip to rip out Abraxos's throat, but if he crunched down long enough, if he cut off her mount's air supply. Manon unleashed another arrow. The wind shifted it enough that she struck the beast's jaw, barely embedding it in the thick hide. Iskra was laughing, laughing as Abraxos fought and could not get free. Manon looked for any of the 13, for anyone to save them, save him. He who mattered more than any other, whom she would trade places with if the three-faced goddess allowed it, to have her own throat gripped in those terrible jaws. But the 13 had been scattered, Iskra's coven plowing their ranks apart. Astarin and Iskra's second were claw to claw as their wyverns locked talons and plunged toward the battlefield. Manon gauged the distance to Iskra's bull, to the jaws around the neck. Weighed the strength of the straps on the reins. If she could swing down, if she was lucky, she might be able to slash at the bull's throat, just enough to pry him off. But Abraxos's wings faltered. His tail, trying so valiantly to strike the bull, began to slow. No, no, not like this, anything but this. Manon slung her bow over her back, half-frozen fingers fumbling with the straps and buckles of the saddle. She couldn't bear it, wouldn't bear it, this death, his pain and fear before it. She might have been sobbing, might have been screaming as his wingbeats faltered again. She'd leap across the god's damned wind, rip that bitch from the saddle, and slit her mount's throat. Abraxos began to fall. Not fall, but dive, trying to get lower, to reach the ground, hauling that bull with him, so Manon might survive. Please! Her scream to Iskra carried across the battlefield, across the world. Please! She would beg. She would crawl if it bought him the chance to live. Her warrior-hearted mount, who had saved her far more than she had ever saved him. Who had saved her in the ways that counted most. Please! She screamed it with every scrap of her shredded soul. Iskra only laughed, and the bull did not let go, even as Abraxos tried and tried to get them closer to the ground. Her tears ripped away in the wind, and Manon freed the last of the buckles on her saddle. The gap between the wyverns was impossible, but she had been lucky before. She didn't care about any of it, the wastes, the crockens and iron teeth, her crown. She didn't care about any of it if Abraxos was not there with her. Abraxos' wings strained, fighting with that mighty, loving heart to reach lower air. Manon sized up the distance to the bull's flank, ripping off her gloves to free her iron nails, as strong as any grappling hook. Manon rose in the saddle, sliding a leg under her, body tensing to make the jump ahead. And she said to Abraxos, touching his spine, I love you. It was the only thing that mattered in the end, the only thing that mattered now. Abraxos thrashed, as if he'd try to stop her. Manon willed strength to her legs, to her arms, and sucked in a breath, perhaps her last. Shooting from the head.